Hello and welcome to the Unscripted SEO Podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Rivera, and I'm here with Garrett Sussman of iPollRank. He's the director of marketing over there. We're going to get into the strange and weird, the awesome and fantastical things in SEO. Maybe touching on the fringe of things, but keeping our fingers on the pulse of SEO. So, Garrett, what would you say you do here at iPollRank? And what have you been seeing recently?
Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for having me. So I am the director of marketing at iPollRank. I work with Mike King, been here for the past 3.5 years. I feel like, are on the forefront. Mike has, you know, was the kind of one of the main architects behind the Google leak that came out in June, kind of peeling back the hood of what Google may or may not be doing with the algorithm. So I help with a lot of marketing of the agency. I work with our clients, but also have hosted my own podcast, Rankable, in the past, the SEO Weekly, as well as focusing on more and more of this intersection between Google and AI search engines, like the ChatGPTs, the Perplexities, like not seeing the market share change yet, but it could happen sooner rather than later, which I'm sure we'll get into.
Definitely. Okay. So two deep paths to go down there, because I haven't had any good resources that actually have been close to the algorithm leak before. So in what two things did you pull out of that you actually took to the bank, took to your strategies and said, okay, we learned this, we're doing X. We learned this, we're doing Y.
Yeah, well, I think the big thing is experimentation, which is not different for SEO, because so much of SEO is really like, yeah, there's all these best practices out there. There's all these recommendations from things people learn from like Rand Fishkin from 12, 14 years ago. But if you're not testing out yourself, like we joke about the it depends, but having experiments to kind of put in place and execute is the name of the game, because your own industry, your own context, your own search queries and keywords that you're focusing on, they are all very specific to your own website and ecosystem. And so when it comes to, you know, the algorithm update, I think, or the leak, excuse me, I think tied with the antitrust trial of the DOJ versus Google, these revelations that Pandu Nayak was talking about, NatBoost, and how Google really is using user behavior potentially through Chrome to impact search rankings, makes you think about what you need to do to ensure that not only are users clicking through the search results to your page, but then like staying there and finding the answers that are satisfying them. So doing a lot of tests in that respect.
Yeah. Okay. So it's about, honestly, it's probably about not taking Google at their word about what anything is or does. And also looking at both brand and personalization, because, and personalization of industry. I've worked in, I did a poop scooper client, I worked in the cannabis industry, asphalt, you know, e-commerce brands, major e-commerce brands, a ton of rehab, different rehabs, and none of those verticals behave the same, you know? So yeah. I think there isn't a standard anymore of like, oh, you need to do X, Y, and Z for SEO. It needs to be first, you know, put into that context of, okay, in your industry and niche, how are your competitors behaving? Because it's going to be a totally different game if you're competing with a bunch of nasty locksmiths who are some of the dirtiest dogs out there when it comes to SEO and willing to pay tons because the turnaround and capital, like the monetization is right there. The other dirty industry is steel door manufacturers. So incredible. There's weird little niches of manufacturing in different places I've run into where the profit margins are just so obscenely good that you just get these, this moral ambiguity going. What's your most morally ambiguous niche you've worked in, and how do you approach industry personalization, we'll call that, or industrialization, like industry-based focus as you take on new clients as a large agency?
Well, you know, it's interesting to your point about the locksmiths is before I was working at iPullRank, I was working for an online review software company called Grade Us. And so I got into SEO through local SEO, which to your point is a whole different approach to SEO with different strategies and metrics that they value compared to a more like informational, like the media publications or e-commerce. So there is a lot of nuance depending on what your goals are from organic search. Like mm-hmm. the way that a locksmith, you know, approaches, you know, proximity and reviews and, you know, door pit, you know, different types of like local landing pages is going to be completely different than, you know, appearing in news SEO for a media publication or, you know, topics or thinking about freshness. You know, it's funny. I haven't worked in any sort of morally ambiguous types of industries, and not because I don't want to. Like, don't get me wrong. I would love to work with, you know, some shady companies or industries. I won't name any to call anyone out, but, I think at iPullRank, because we work at enterprises, Lily Ray talks about this a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a lot less, there's a lot more risk adversity. Yeah. Where you really can't afford to do anything that is, you know, breaks SEO guidelines because mm-hmm. you're thinking long term. And even with the, you know, the last 18 months of the HCU, helpful content update and AI overviews, you know, there's a lot of instability and volatility across all brands, although brands continue to get elevated more and more in the search results. So, It's interesting, like, how the way that we approach SEO, I think, is changing, but the fundamentals are still the same.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. I think there are aspects of that are true. I have played in the enterprise SEO space as well. Like, with I had to take a drug test in order to make some edits to HCA's website. Like, I had to take a drug test. I had to go and sit on my laptop on their campus, and the security guard was watching me while I edit their website. I'm like, this is a ridiculous level of red tape. Like, I edited like 15 pages, you know, over 2 days. And like as a subcontractor, I'm like, wow, that is why that's a lot of red tape to go through to make some minor edits. No wonder their site is so stagnant. Like, it takes so much to get some things going. But there is kind of the statement that all enterprises don't break Google guidelines. Forbes.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, that there's, yeah. So there's, if you read AJ Cohn's, like, It's Google Enough article from last year, or especially, there is that idea of brands get away with more, that they don't have to follow the guidelines. But as we're seeing more recently, you know, with the site reputation abuse kind of manual penalties that are going mm-hmm. out, it's like at any given moment, your runway can end. You know, and so, like, for media publications, that's a real big challenge because for the longest time, the monetization of ad revenue has been decreasing as people like expect free content and expect mm-hmm. free news. And so news publications have had that challenge, and they've kind of pivoted more and more towards affiliate marketing. Mm-hmm. And that's how they, you know, generate so much more revenue. But there is that argument among SEOs that, like, a business publication like Forbes that focused on the business industry shouldn't necessarily be able to abuse their brand to show up for CBD gummies. But then the argument right now is, like, who deserves to be up there? Like, why is New York Times and Wirecutter being traded differently than Forbes? And I do have some thoughts on that, but yeah, that's what we're seeing.
I was talking to Morty in the previous episode about the site reputation abuse, and I think that there is a bit of monkey paw effect mm-hmm. that we're going to see in SEO as it moves from manual penalties. And finally, like, Google always does this thing. They use their fear to get people to fall in line before, as a tool, before they'll do more things that are algorithmic. We've seen this with multiple different aspects of SEO, like when we had tremendous success with guest posting. They came in and, you know, slapped a few people around and said, no, guest posting, bad. But, you know, then kind of backing off on how they actually, like, implemented that in the actual algorithm and, like, the manual penalties and the fear around it that was generated of, like, oh, no, I can't do this. I don't want to do any guest posts anywhere ever because, you know, these people got slapped down so hard. But then when you come back to, okay, if we test this out and see, like, okay, what was it that actually triggered this? What are they saying was the problem versus what's the actual strategy? And now, like, you can't do away with the idea of having experts going to other places to be interviewed. Or content being created and placed elsewhere on other people's sites. So Google has kind of seemingly backed off of their original, like, strong, you know, no guest posts, you know, don't abuse it. But now we have another area with site reputation where we wanted them to slap down Forbes and, like, you don't deserve to rank for CBD gummies. Come on. Like, there's so many ridiculous examples we can point to, but as we, like, that stay in your lane, how far can you write? Like, are you a thought leader or are you just really posting something to, because you can make money as you've developed this level of brand or visibility or strength, you know, like, as it comes to algorithmic, how do you see that playing out?
Well, I have mixed feelings on the fundamental issue, which is, first off, you always got to look at what Google is incentivizing, right? Like, Google incentivizes boring copycat content. You know, like, if you are too outside the realm of the mainstream, you know, are you going to appeal to the largest swath of users? And I think sometimes we forget as SEOs of what people feel like they're entitled to because they think they're the best versus what users, people searching actually like. Like, this came up with Reddit, people being frustrated with Reddit surfacing at the top of so many different search results and them, you know, jumping to 500 million keywords that they're ranking for. Whereas there are a lot of times where Reddit results are what people want. Same thing with AI overviews. Like, we're so quick to criticize these, like, kind of crappy summaries that are generated by AI. But, you know, Sundar Pichai is saying, like, that's what people like. And it's easy to be skeptical of what Google says, but the average non-SEO, non-marketer might actually find that more rewarding. And so I know as SEOs, we joke about how Forbes deserve to get, you know, not ranked for CBD gummies because it's not in their topical sort of wheelhouse. And yet I find myself looking at the different results in the top 10. And the reality is a site like Forbes has a ton of money and resources to produce good content. It might not be the best content, but it's actually better than a lot of the other stuff out there. And so regardless of whether or not they topically deserve to be, like, the definitive niche experts, if their content is better than the niche experts, then, like, why should they be penalized?
There is that. Somebody posted on Blue Sky last week and they're like, okay, Google's broken, Reddit's broken. Can you tell me, like, audio equipment, like, what's actually good and why are results for it so bad? And my take on that was, well, the incentive cycle is really messed up because you have a situation where somebody who is truly an audiophile, you know, like, is he going to take the time and energy to, like, really write this in-depth, detailed review, photos, you know, a video of the inside, comparing, you know, it, this audio equipment to another, like, what would he get out of that? Like, you know, in early internet days, it'd be like the obsession with the craft and trade. But at this point, like, you know, like, you have to look at who is incentivized to do that. And, like, you might have an influencer out there who, you know, they can get those affiliate relationships and make some money for by going down and breaking this out. And but that's monetized, you know, so there's always a in some monetary incentive driving that piece of content. So I don't think that in this day and age that we can expect to see, you know, any actual like quality sites building that level of quality content that people want. So what people look for instead is honest input. Like, okay, an audiophile is probably might be participating in a forum, or they might be on Reddit and they have a fantastic insight and they'll throw it out there, but not with the expectation of like getting paid. It's just because they're arguing with somebody who disagrees with them.
Totally. And even just to that point of like, you think about the way the traditional media used to work and where reviews used to come from. We used to have the critics that weren't incentivized.
Right. They were incentivized to create investigative in-depth pieces to go out and – but from a journalistic neutral third party. We've broken journalism in a lot of ways.
Right.
Like SEOs have broken journalism.
Exactly. And you see it like, yeah, when you have, whether it's a niche blogger or even the big, you know, folks like the Wirecutters, like you can tell it's so affiliate driven and you don't know if they're giving the best result. The other aspect of it is sometimes, and you point this out with Reddit, is like not in the audio file, but sometimes you don't want the expert opinion. Like sometimes you want the, who's the person like me? That I'm not an audiophile, but like I need good headphones. Who's another, you know, 40 something marketer dad who, you know, is just using his headphones doing podcasts and whatnot? Like,
I was joking with my wife and she's like, you know, you should make a website that's like okay recipes. Not like there's so many like best recipes out there. You should be not like bad recipes, like, you know, this is garbage, but like totallyacceptablefood.com. Like, you can make this and eat it. It's fine. Like, it's finefood.com. Like, recipes that are just okay. Like, you're not, it's not the best out there. Like, you're literally, you're instead of your two block intro of like, oh, I was hanging out with my friends and we had the most magical experience making this meal. Like, no, I really threw this together in about 10 minutes. Here's the recipe and you'll eat it and you'll survive.
Dude, I mean, it's funny, but it's true, because it's like I hate that I find myself more and more siding with Google on a lot of things, because I do think they're evil and I do think they're very ad revenue driven in a lot of ways. Maybe they weren't always, but I do also think that this is an impossible problem. And I was saying this in response to Blair McGregor wrote a really great article kind of going through what we're talking about. In the context of Google being broken. And I was like, you know, there are two things that can be true. Google can be editorial in the results. They can ultimately be choosing what they consider the best content, because unless it's definitively factual that can be a feature snippet or can be an AI overview, there's a nuance and subjectivity to definitive to these answers. And the other part is the algorithm can also be broken. They could have rolled out the helpful content update and had too many false positives because it's not doing what they intended and they don't know how to fix it. And this leads to this really challenging problem for whether you are a niche content creator or an enterprise brand that's benefiting from, you know, your brand recognition. If Google's not getting it right, no one's entitled to that, but it's how do you define what is the best anyway?
And I think part of my concern is not so much, it's yes, I think there are ways that Google is quote unquote getting it wrong. When it comes to the algorithm and what it's ranking and what it's showing, that often it's good enough. AJ Cohn is one of my favorite authors on that aspect of things. But at the same time, I feel like whoever is in charge of optics, whoever is in charge of talking to SEOs in the SEO industry and giving their orders to Danny and giving the orders to John Mu, they're tying their hands, because what we actually need is a little more transparency. What we need is if we're hit by HCU and it's going to give a site-wide penalty because of these pieces of content, we need in Google Search Console for us to see what pieces of content are causing the site-wide problem, because it's a blindness factor, right? Like, okay, this part of the site has cancer, but the whole thing is dying. Then you start looking at the head to the tail and you're like, okay, well, I'm going to try to fix the head. No, that didn't work. Okay, I'm going to try to fix the middle. No, that didn't work. I'm going to fix this. And then you have to wait until the next update to maybe have some impact or not, to know whether or not you did something to the right piece. And so there's this feeling of failure as an SEO that comes with like trying to deal with an HCU site. I don't know if you've run into one or have a team who have one that you're at least 90% sure. Nobody's 100% sure that you are like, it kind of lines up. You're pretty sure, but maybe it's another thing. It's something where in the past, like I'm thinking Penguin, I'm thinking Panda. Panda came out, you went down. You looked at your broken link, you looked at your link profile and like, yeah, okay, we deserve to get slapped around. Sorry, let's sacrifice a few goats. You know, let's do what we need to and apologize and clean up the link profile. And you did the action, then you could come back, or the site was dead. Like it was A or B. Now we have this situation where there are so many HCU impacted sites where we just literally don't know if what we're doing is just, embalming a body that's never going to come back to life.
I mean, so this leads to another like kind of philosophical challenge of which I hate to say, like, you know, on the side of Google is like, there's that line, and I know John Mueller and Danny deal with this all the time, is like every little thing they say can be taken as gospel and definitive. And so our jobs as SEOs is to reverse engineer Google, right? To figure it out whether or not we are actually, I mean, yes, there are good people out there who want to provide good content and make the internet a better place, but like a lot of people are revenue focused or money focused. And for the good moralistic people out there, there's going to be 10, 100 other people who are just trying to game the system, optimize, manipulate to, you know, get on top regardless. And so there's always going to be that, you know, they say this cat and mouse game between not giving away, you know, the ingredients or the recipe and also pointing people in the right direction of what Google wants to see. The question is, and this goes back to, you know, Google deciding editorially what is helpful content, mm-hmm. right? It is ultimately what they can program the machine, the algorithms to determine is the best content, because they don't, I think they're one of the problems up until this point is they have incentivized vanilla, boring, crappy content, and they haven't rewarded not, you know, like more interesting, more dynamic, more helpful content. And they haven't necessarily figured that out, and they have to rely on brands because that's what people want. And there's all sorts of reasons why this is just a really hard challenge for them.
All right. Sorry for the hiccup in the middle of your fantastic rant, I'm sure. Can you start ranting again on that point?
No, what I was saying was I really hate that I keep siding with Google on this, but I think there's a major challenge for them to try to play this cat and mouse game where they're trying to incentivize and point SEOs and content creators in a certain direction to improve the results on the internet, whereas not giving away the secret sauce that would allow people to manipulate it and get content that's not useful. And we've seen up to this point that, you know, there has been so much incentivization of vanilla, boring content that just kind of answers a question, but is considered SEO content. And I don't think they've figured out how to surface. Like I remember, you know, a year ago, Marie Haynes would point out this whole idea of the hidden gems, that they were going to pull out these like unique, you know, non-commercial sort of types of sites to surface. And I don't think they know how to do it effectively.
I mean, and there's as much question of do they actually exist, because the incentive right. cycle hasn't existed for to support or create them. Because you have, if we think back to the first HCU, and what startled so many SEOs was the blatant statement of we're targeting content that was created for SEO. And you're like,
yes,
excuse me? Like, I mean, like, there's so, like, that's 3/4 of the internet is created for the purpose of being quality content and ranking and getting the traffic and supporting it. And so you dial back of like, okay, well, which site, which bucket of sites did they first target with HCU? And it was programmatic sites. It was celebrity birthday sites that were programmatically copy and pasting the same profile. And it was also interestingly, like some niche sites that topically they had obviously taken all of the people also ask questions for a niche, one that I saw was for like Naruto, and they made their own versions that weren't that much better and slapped ads on it. There was no business. There was nothing to buy. There was nothing to purchase. There was just ads, and the whole site existed to copy and paste a different, slightly different version of the current, what seemed to be the current PAAs. So from that perspective, it's like, okay, well, you know, the reason the person made that site was to make money from that site existing because it was going to get Google organic traffic. And so their statement was like, well, that's bad. But if you extend that model further of like how much content on the internet actually exists as a business model, how many publishers exist as a business model based off of creating consumable content that for the most part gets its traffic from organic search and monetizes using ads. That's a huge section of the internet. And, you know, like the incentives are all twisted around. Like at what point do these third-party affiliate models and these products that you want to get out there creating mini ecosystems, creating content that's going to rank, like how do you deal with that as Google? But also how do you, as an SEO, like, you know, you're given a mission and a job of like, okay, I'm going to hire to help me rank this content. Like, okay, well, I'm hired to rank this content. Like, okay, I'm going to do my best to make great content. Just because I'm not Forbes doesn't mean that what I'm putting out isn't helpful.
Well, it's a big problem. And that's why I think Google relies so heavily on brand signals, is that there, it's really hard, I think, for them to determine what is more trustworthy, from a new website or a new, you know, slice of content that comes up if they haven't established that trust. And, you know, why we see all this EEAT when you have, you know, all these generative AI sort of sites spinning out content, you know, ruining the game for everyone. And so I think that it makes sense why things, it would be hard to get in there. It's almost like you think about, you know, professional sports. It's not like you can automatically just decide one day you're going to show up and compete at the professional level just because, you know, you got some really nice new shoes to help you out. Like, it doesn't work like that. So it's not surprising that we're seeing brands, you know, they don't have to play by the rules. They can be, so it's there's so many different factors. They have more money, they have more brand recognition, they've been there longer. It makes sense, even if they're not doing it as well as other people.
So I think if we look at it, Google is using brand signals as a proxy for real world signals.
Yeah.
They're using that as a proxy, because it used to be that links, you know, like PageRank, the reason why it differentiated in 1998 from AltaVista is because at that time, all of the links that were being created, there was no incentive for content to be out there that was giving links to other things that weren't actually, you know, journalistically related to each other, or there's an enthusiast sending this link. So now Google is looking at it, and you know, SEOs looked at rank signals and link signals and crank things up to 11. And so I think from a like unbranded anchor link perspective, a lot of the PBNs that SEOs have created over the years have really shown Google, hey, you need a cleaner signal as a proxy for authority than just relying on links. I think what they've done is amplify the value of branded links and amplify the value of branded search. So clicks, actually branded search and clicks as a proxy. So if you're doing like, and you can see this effect, if you have any company that does a popular event and they get a boost of branded search, like I worked with a no-name brand called Innovar, and they do office rebuilding, or they redesign offices. They're a furniture dealer or whatever. And like I did all of the solid SEO stuff first. And they're like, you know, it's taking too long. We're not really seeing the outcome and impact. And I'm like, month three, like, gotten great links, you know, non-branded links from all of these genuine different sources. And they're like, well, we're going to stop this and we're going to run some TV ads. And I'm like, okay, well, I mean, if you need me again, let me know. And I just looked at their profile after the TV ads, and their branded search went up, doubled. And then their non-branded search then went up in the following month. And so that gives me a context and clue of like, okay, well, you know, that those TV ads led to branded searches for what they do, which led to Google seeing and giving them trust as a brand. And then all of the SEO work, foundation work that I did then started paying off. So it's like, I think brand and branded query search is starting to become an important signal that SEOs need to optimize for. And that means doing real world stuff. That means, you know, organizing trash cleanups. That means going on podcasts. That means hosting webinars, doing events, running audio ads elsewhere where people have to search for your brand afterwards. I think it was Rand Fishkin who said that actually you should expect more out of your dark social efforts. Like TikTok is not optimized for links. Like people hear a TikTok video and they hear the mention of a name or a brand, there's no link to click. You got to Google that stuff. You know, so like the R signal ratio of what we're looking for as SEOs is starting to shift. Like, you know, getting an influencer to name drop your brand can obviously have as much of an SEO impact as it does a potential traffic impact.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's obviously we're speculating here, makes so much sense as to why that would be the case, especially in addition to that, what we were saying earlier about the user signals and user behavior, like clicking through and going, you know, clicking on the search rankings. And you would also anticipate a more recognizable brand in the search results is more likely to be clicked on. And that would then give the more signals that should be ranking higher in the search results as well. So it's this like cycle of, you know, real world popularity with engagement on the actual search results with the high quality content that a lot of these bigger brands that have the resources are putting out. It makes sense that they would rise to the top across the board.
How do you think that might play out as we see the rise of Perplexity, LLM-based search engines? I know, again, Rand Fishkin, he's been doing a lot of good stuff over at SparkToro. His whiteboard Friday on it was that you can ask these LLM models, okay, what is the best sous chef in Seattle? And then once they do, say, what sources did you use to determine that? Like, and they'll tell you, unlike Google, they'll actually tell you and say, hey, I was referencing this article that I read and this article and from this newspaper. And like, okay, well, that's PR and link building, you know, and looking for like, those opportunities for them to have held a dinner honoring those sous chefs, and, you know, getting your chef out there to be celebrated. So is it just that, you know, we need to think about digital PR, that we need to like think about the other parts of businesses and their marketing teams and not silo ourselves off into a corner staring at our SEMrush numbers, saying, oh, this volume's higher, we need to do this, instead of saying, okay, let's get the marketing team together. And what are the efforts, all of the marketing efforts that are going out there, and how do we leverage those? Or, you know, for us, that's easy to say at an enterprise level, but like, what does that look like for small businesses that don't have a big team?
Right. I think so. When you bring AI search channels into the conversation, I think that is a whole different, like, future looking, aspect of things, which I personally find fascinating. So I've been working with this, brand monitoring AI search software called Profound, and they're looking at ChatGPT, Perplexity, Copilot in terms of the visibilities of brands. And what's interesting about thinking about those is, A, we have to take into consideration the two different models. There's the ones that aren't internet connected, like ChatGPT pre-search, where it was based purely on the existing data that it was trained on, which originally was like back in 2021, and then they updated it, but it wasn't being augmented with new information. Now you have Perplexity and Search ChatGPT, which actually does connect to the internet using retrieval augmented generation, check for results on the internet, and then integrate that into their answers. What makes it really challenging for SEOs is that the nature of search through AI search channels isn't going to be the head level keywords that we're used to. It's much more going to be natural language searches, which lead to more granularity that won't have the same sort of search volume. So you almost need to think about your visibility at a topic level as opposed to a keyword level.
Okay. Expand on that a little bit.
Yep. So think about if I'm having a conversation with ChatGPT and I feel comfortable asking about, you know, what are the best toys for my toddler for Black Friday? You know, I'm not necessarily going to just say, you know, Black Friday toys toddler, you know, the way that we're used to. I'm going to say, hey, you know, I've got a little girl. She's, you know, 2.5 years old. She's really into Sesame Street right now. I want some educational toy that you recommend. What do you think? That's a query that no one's ever going to do again, right? Like, that's a one and done.
Yeah.
And I feel like as we get more and more comfortable, this conversational search is going to change the way that we think about how we want to appear, how we want to be the recommended brand. Because in that case with Search GPT, it's not even using Google. It's for the most part depending on Bing's index to source where they're going to get their citations from and what they recommend and the publishers there. So it's a completely different ecosystem, even though, you know, it's still a search engine.
That's true. I just wonder how many like Bing employees, if they ever hear this, are like, yay, we got mentioned. It's our time to shine.
Well, I would say for everyone to hold their horses on the market impact, because Google still has 90% of market share. And, you know, I've seen Kevin Indig write about the idea of like, we could see some sort of exponential growth of ChatGPT usage, and people are starting to see, you know, attribution to ChatGPT and analytics that people found them that way. But like, it hasn't happened yet, you know, like people aren't using that technology as the default for their search in 2024. Now, it could be the next 6 months, a year, it could be 5 years from now. I think it'll inevitably like replace the standard way we think about search, but it's not tomorrow.
Isn't it funny though that like, how long has Siri been on the market?
Mm-hmm, for 7-8 years, if not more than that. 10-15.
But there's such a chasm between Siri responses and ChatGPT search results.
Yes, absolutely. Well, they're fundamentally different architecture. Until Google kind of, the folks who created the transformer technology at Google, like when they were working at Google before they moved to AI, you know, there, it wasn't that sort of neural networks that they were building that allowed you to have this satisfying conversational search that could produce the results that we're seeing now from ChatGPT or the other LLMs compared to like Siri. Like Siri was still like very basic and couldn't interact with other like tools within the Apple ecosystem. So it's very limited. And frustrating.
It was frustrating. It still is frustrating. And it makes you wonder, like, how intentional it was for it to remain frustrating, you know, as we look at Google's, you know, making strategic monopoly plays to keep its dominance. How much has that aspect of what's the most common interface for people to use now to access the internet, it's your phone. Like the majority of people access the internet through the phone. And we have, you know, speech capability. We have an interface built into the device, but still we see so much more growth in value and depth with what GPT search, Claude and others have been able to make something that's much more much less frustrating. And I wonder if Google intentionally stunted that to push people to continue to do more traditional searches.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very fascinating narrative timeline. I did a lot of research, wrote about the DOJ antitrust trial and how one of the big cases or the big arguments from the government was that Google was able to establish and maintain its monopoly based on being the default search engine across browsers, hardware manufacturers, and then their own like Android devices. They have their deal with Apple where they pay Apple, you know, billions of dollars to be the default search engine on Apple devices. Same with Samsung. And so to your point, yeah, and they also benefit to improve the product by the data they get from having so many more searches. Like they have 17 years worth of more like search data than Bing. And that allows them to make their, you know, search engine significantly a better experience. It wasn't until Samsung started to discuss the emergence of ChatGPT and then Samsung's decision to potentially break that deal that Google really started to move fast with Bard, which became Gemini, which, you know, was AI overviews to like accelerate that AI visual integration. Because you got to remember that Google was using AI driven machine learning algorithms under the hood with Mom and Palm 2 and whatnot. It just wasn't the whole AI natural language processing conversational aspect of it that showed up until ChatGPT like forced their hand.
I can buy that. So kind of wrapping things up, based off of what you've been working on, based off of you know, what you're looking forward to happening next, what are some fundamentals that you have been putting into place on your accounts on the execution side of things?
Well, you know, as we were talking about at the beginning, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I still believe that a lot of the fundamentals of audience-driven content that's optimized for search engines with like various different structures and schema to be able to easily understood by machines is the best process, including, you know, expertise and experience, like really, you know, using a lot of Google's guidelines. That said, we are paying attention to Google's continued integration of AI features into the search results. For instance, we know AI overviews are here. They're here to stay. They're expanding more and more. Over the last like 3 or 4 months, Google's integrated AI organized shopping. We're seeing more and more AI organized search results in the context of they promise like recipes and informational and local and all that, in terms of like things to do. And it's giving you all these different like topic carousels that are AI related that are expansions of what your search is, trying to anticipate what else you would be looking for next. And I think that's going to be the direction. So as we move away from 100% focusing on individual keywords, mm-hmm. we're going to want to continue to focus on the customer journey in the context of topics and really expand the content to cover every single point that someone would search in the journey, so that even if someone searches for things to do in, you know, in New York City, that your client or your website or whoever's listening to this shows up in all the different kind of topical carousels and subtopics that you could potentially show up in.
I think there was something I saw last week where the intent of like 82 million searches had been broken down at looking at the query as to like what was the intent, the bucket that the query fell into for intent. And I, of course, as an SEO, was like, okay, well, how do I write for that? How do I break apart that intent? Is it an article that addresses multiple intents that going to perform better, or one intent? And the author of that data is like, no, like, you may come to those conclusions, but I was just saying, like, here's the data, and think about optimizing for the query. You know, it does fit different intents. Like, is it a Boolean? Is it a yes, no that they're looking for? Is it a qualitative difference between those two? What's your take on that type of data and creating content in those veins?
Yeah, I mean, Mark Williams Cook talked about the idea that Google does classify by those intent types. And so I think, you know, that's where audience research really comes into play and looking at individual like SERPs. But it makes it hard when you are an enterprise that's trying to scale to, you know, millions of pages across hundreds of millions of SERPs. So it really... what SEO podcast would this be if I didn't say it depends? It really depends on what your resources are, what your focus is, and what you're trying to accomplish, whether it's like very individual, you know, granular, or at volume and scale, like what are the strategies that you can do to accomplish that? But I think ultimately, intent is something that you need to pay attention to, because that's going to satisfy the user, which would ultimately, in theory, get rewarded by the algorithms if you create content for the specific intent and people click on it and stay there.
What if you set the intent of the intent not to just rank, but to try to get the person, the reader, to stay and engage and read more and do more?
It depends on the query. I mean, there's a lot of I think there's a certain entitlement that a lot of websites feel when it comes to organic search, that, you know, people should come to their site for the content. However, more and more informational search is commodified. It's like you see the same 10 brands saying the same exact thing. It's like, who goes back to earlier in our conversation, who is like the best version of that if you're basically saying the same thing every time? So it doesn't surprise me that Google would be rolling out these AI overviews and people would just stay on the SERP and not leave. So going back to your question around intent, the focus should really be is like, what is the type of content that isn't commodified, that you're very unique, and, you know, it might not be the same volume that you're used to with organic search, but that will actually drive business revenue, right? Like whether it's further down the funnel and it's more specific to what you're offering, or if it's like just in the middle of the funnel, but you can differentiate yourself and really like steal those clicks. If you haven't nailed that, that's probably where you want to start, as opposed to focusing a lot on top of the funnel stuff that can be commodified by anybody.
Part of my heart is like, do we as SEOs have to step back and say, how much of my heart is in the process of creating content with the purpose of getting it to rank as a fundamental like concept? Because if Google is facing this intractable problem of, well, if people keep intentionally creating content that's just designed to rank, and we don't want to rank content that's just designed to rank, how do we as SEOs continue to exist to optimize for search if we're not supposed to optimize for search?
Right. Like, and that's the cat and mouse game, right? Like there, it is still a machine. It's still like using quantifiable metrics to decide what is going to rank in the algorithm. They're just becoming maybe more complex, maybe counterintuitive, maybe easier, harder to like parse out and figure out, because, you know, I always go through this battle in my head of overestimating and underestimating Google at the same time. Like, do we give them too much credit or not enough? Which, you know, a lot of times it's not enough. Yeah.
A lot of times it's not enough, and a lot of times it is way too much. Definitely. Like, I know, you know, I've been to a lot of SEO conferences over the years, and, you know, sometimes you meet people at these conferences and they're like a Sith Lord sitting next to you being like, come to the dark side. Google is evil. We're the good guys. We're, you know, finding the edge cases and proving what they're saying is wrong. And, you know, we've been given a mission by the businesses we work with to bring them traffic and revenue and money through this channel. And, you know, if Google says that they don't value, meta keywords anymore, well, we shouldn't take them at their word. We should test it. And, you know, if it works, then we should continue to put as many meta keywords in there as possible. It's Google's responsibility and Google's broken algorithm that's rewarding us. So if they didn't want it to happen, then they would take the resources and time to make a fair algorithm that actually sorted through results and gave great results. It's not my fault that they're incentivizing the meta keywords having this value. That doesn't mean that I'm not going to make a bunch of money by having pages and pages of white text on a white background for as long as having white pages on white text on a white background. If they don't want that to rank, they should make that not rank in the algorithm.
I mean, in the grand scheme of things, Google's a private business with revenue-driven incentives themselves, which they're, you know, we live in a consumer capitalist society, at least in the US, where it's like more and more and more, bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, in my opinion, obviously, I think search should be like a public utility, but it's not. No one has, you know, no government has the money to really do that as a free service. So it's like we have our libraries here, but we don't have a digital library. And so as long as you have a corporation that runs the algorithm with, you know, their ad revenues driving them, they're going to make those decisions. And, you know, they have a responsibility to maintain trust. Because if people don't use the search engine, then they're not going to get the advertisers and the revenues. And then that's, you know, a collapsing, empire. But until then, until they lose that trust, they can do what they want.
So reality is what it is. And, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, as long as businesses can make money off people arriving from search, people like me will get paid to try to find ways to increase that amount and use, you know, different tactics to do so, some which some people will assign moral value to and some won't.
SEO's not going anywhere, man. I mean, like, even if Google is not the way that we search, humans are curious. They need to find a way to search for information. And there's going to be some platform and ecosystem that marketers and SEOs will want to optimize for visibility for. So it's a game that's changing, but it's not a game that's ever going to go away.
You hit it on the head. Thank you so much for that philosophical end. Like, do I exist? Yes, I SEO. I optimize, therefore I exist.
I love it. And it's true. It's true, man. You're good. Sleep better tonight.
I'm going to. Thanks so much, Gary.
Thanks, Jeremy.